Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of my Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from November 2, 2017. My talk and our discussion is the first of three talks on the Eightfold Path. This talk is on right view and right intention. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is the first of three on the Eightfold Path. I know you've heard me say this often, but to keep everything in context, and especially tonight's talk, everything the Buddha taught was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths. To understand the origination and the continuance of stress and suffering, and how to bring our own individual contributions to that, to cessation. And the path that he taught is an Eightfold Path, which is characterized as a path of heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration. Everything that the Buddha taught during his 45-year teaching career was taught in that context, in the context of Four Noble Truths, and framed by the Eightfold Path. So you couldn't... That's the wrong way to say that. Any sutta that you look at from the Sutta Pitaka relates in some way to one or all of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. And in a general way, to right view. Right view is the overarching factor of the Eightfold Path. In other words, it includes, fully awakened right view includes the integration of all eight factors of the Eightfold Path. So the first two factors are right view and right intention. It's both the entry point into developing the Dhamma. Initial right view is simply the acceptance that the views that I'm holding about myself in relation to the world currently are not working for me. There's something missing. And all of us come to a so-called spiritual practice, whether it's what the Buddha taught or something else, because we think that there's something lacking in our life, or we're just confused about life. We feel that there should be more, or we're just looking for answers. Ultimately, that leads to the understanding that the reason why I'm thinking that way and feeling that way is because my views are lacking true reality, a true reflection of what's occurring in the world. It's just a wrong view. I'm going to begin reading about 40% into this article. The article's on the website and linked in the email. Ultimately, right view is a perspective of a mind resting in the Dhamma, free of the distraction of stress, an awakened mind. When the Buddha described an awakened mind from the perspective of right view, he said right view is a view that understands on a very profound level stress. We understand the nature of suffering. Why is that so important? It's because it is our preoccupation with chasing after those things that make us happy and doing everything we can to avoid anything that we think would take away from that happiness or security. Or anything, and the third factor of that is our ambiguity to everything else that doesn't get our attention in that way, which is simply another distraction, isn't it? So the problem of dukkha, the preoccupation with dukkha, is the constant distraction related to it. Again, always chasing after what we think we need to be happy, doing everything we can to avoid unhappiness. And that, the continuation of that is a constant producer of underlying stress that most of us don't even realize. And of course, we are just realizing in the last 20 years something that the Buddha said 2,600 years ago, the debilitating effects of constant stress on our lives. And how do we deal with it? Dealing with stress is not a matter of creating a life where we can go sit on a beach under a palm tree for the rest of our life, although that's a nice start. That doesn't change the underlying inner contributions to stress. Every time the wind blows, well, we don't want the wind to be blowing, I'm on this perfect beach. Or it drops below 70 degrees, I'm disappointed because I like it when it's 75 degrees. You see where I'm going with this? When a self-referential ego self, something rooted in wrong views, is never satisfied with what's going on. But a mind that is awakened, that understands the nature of stress and the impermanent nature of all things, is a mind that rests in equanimity no matter how the wind is blowing, no matter what's occurring in life. Right view develops gradually. Initially, an understanding that life in the phenomenal world is stressful and the cause of stress is clinging begins the development of wisdom. That relates to the second noble truth. Through integrating all eight factors of the Eightfold Path, right view develops understanding that penetrates to the root of suffering. In other words, it's not a practice that mollifies suffering in some way or distracts us in another way, using something that's so-called spiritual to just ignore our own suffering, which is what a lot of practices that were common during the Buddha's time and also very common today. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do things that make us feel better in the moment, but we should understand what we're doing about that. So the Buddha taught a very specific path of recognizing and abandoning our own contributions to stress and suffering, not simply creating more strategies that would allow us to ignore our own suffering. Is that clear? So there's a lot of things that we do. An extreme example would be someone who's caught up in different types of addiction or compulsive behavior. Those are great strategies to ignore your own ignorance and ignore the suffering that's common in all our lives. But we do that on much more subtle levels too, not just extreme levels of compulsive behavior and addiction. It might be, in modern terms, just being stuck on Facebook all the time and that constant interaction and entanglements with the world. It might be watching TV. It might be playing too much golf. It might be shooting pool. It might be hanging out at the tavern. It might be knitting. It might be painting. It might be a combination of all of the above. But we create very, very busy lives to continue the distraction that allows us to not have to face our own contributions to stress and suffering. And these become very subtle at times. They're very hard to recognize. And if we can't recognize it, we can't abandon it. And we tend to associate with people that engage in the same type of distractions that we engage in, because that allows us to justify it by simply the numbers that are involved. And that's true in modern Buddhist practices, and it's true in just about every human activity. We take things to extremes often to continue that distraction. Developing right view is developing wisdom. The Buddha describes right view. And what is right view? Notice the simplicity of this description. Knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regard to the path or practice that develops the cessation of stress. This is called right view. And notice how each one of those relates directly to the Four Noble Truths. Again, everything the Buddha taught was in that vein, to understand and to recognize and abandon the cause of all stress and suffering in the world. My words, right view is knowledge and understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Right view is a view that supports developing concentration and wisdom, the other factors of the Eightfold Path. Right view is considered the forerunner of the path, and this is what I mean when I say that right view is both the entry point to the Eightfold Path, to understanding Four Noble Truths, and the ultimate goal of the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's words. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view as wrong view. We simply understand it. But think about the profundity of that one simple statement. If you're stuck in a wrong view or a deluded view, if you're deluded about anything, how can that mind understand that it's deluded? It's the nature of delusion to continue delusion, isn't it? Another way of saying that is, how would a mind that's rooted in ignorance understand that it's ignorant? Because it's a nature of ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge that ignorance. That's what the Buddha awakened to. Dependent origination states that from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises, rooted in ignorance. So how do we overcome the debilitating effects of our own ignorance from recognizing wrong view? But again, the question is, how do we do it? We need a framework for looking at our own minds from the perspective of a deluded view, but pointing towards an awakened view. The brilliance of the Buddha is he figured that out. It's called an Eightfold Path. Go back that one line. One discerns wrong view as wrong view, and right view as right view. We understand the difference now. This is one's right view. And what is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world or next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously born beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. What does all that mean? Can anybody explain that? Please don't ask me to do it. But I will. It's a lot of words saying that an unawakened person doesn't understand the nature of eye-making. So we're constantly establishing the self in this world, and we create scenarios about establishing ourselves in other worlds. The Buddha would sometimes describe that as always here and always there. What it means is every thought that occurs, every event that occurs, we need it, meaning an unawakened mind needs it to be a self-referential thought or a self-referential view. We're always seeing a self in there, a permanent self. It's a misunderstanding of the nature of impermanence in the world. The beginning of that, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. The Buddha's talking at a time when sacrifice and that type of ritualistic engagement in spiritual practices was very common. Human sacrifices, animal sacrifices, and then mundane sacrifices, meaning sacrificing maybe food or things like that, was a very common practice. What the Buddha is referring to as being nothing offered up or nothing sacrificed is we're not willing to give up any view that we're holding. There's nothing sacrificed there. We're maintaining these wrong views. And he's really speaking specifically to wrong views rather than sacrificing physical objects or even sacrificing ourselves, again, which is a common practice. We have to be willing to recognize and abandon things that we've created ownership over, meaning ultimately our own thoughts, but also the things that we've attached ourselves to, our associations. We have to be willing to sacrifice those. And as we begin to, another word for sacrificing is letting go of clinging and maintaining. And it's really not until we start doing that on a very simple and direct level that we realize we're not giving up anything of any value. And ultimately, we realize we're not giving up anything. The Buddha describes those things that we use and attach ourselves to as like foam on the ocean. There's nothing there. In what I just read, the Buddha here is describing the ignorance and the consequences of wrong view. And just to go in a little bit deeper into what I just said. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, faring rightly and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly known and realized it for themselves. That refers to lacking understanding of the process of becoming calm and rebirth. So those of you that were on retreat understand maybe becoming a little bit more in this reference. Each moment holds the potential of what we are going to become in the next moment, and by inference, the rest of this life, and if you want to get into future lives, in our future lives. That potential is in each moment. What we become is determined by what we're holding in mind and what we're associated with, which is essentially the same thing. If we're holding in mind in this present moment a well-integrated mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, and the next moment and the remainder of our life, as long as we're on that path, will incline our minds towards awakening. We'll be giving birth to another moment that allows for becoming more awakened in each moment. Continuing ignorance of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, can only give birth to further ignorance. That's reasonable, isn't it? And it's easily understood? Is it? I mean, is that clear? Nobody has any questions about that? Because it really is such an important point of, and this isn't to become hyper-vigilant about what's occurring in this moment and to get too over-focused of what am I thinking about? The gentleness that comes from a well-developed and well-integrated Eightfold Path is an understanding of this ongoing process and the necessity to be very gentle with what's occurring. In other words, even when we find that we're acting in a way that is obviously rooted in wrong view, to not judge ourselves harshly for that, to simply recognize it. Because it's an aspect of the Eightfold Path to take everything in an impersonal way, especially as we start recognizing and developing the Eightfold Path. if we start judging ourselves harshly for not being completely aligned 100% of the time with the Eightfold Path, we're never going to get anywhere. Because that judgment, that harsh judgment of ourselves, is an aspect of wrong view, isn't it? An aspect of right view is accepting that right now in this moment, if I'm acting in a way that is contrary to the Eightfold Path, I'm acting from a point of wrong view. What do we do with it? We recognize it solely for the reason to abandon it, not to analyze it, not to use it for more judgments, not to blame the view or the resulting action on other people, and certainly not on ourselves, to recognize it and abandon it. That's why right view is the forerunner of developing the Eightfold Path. We have to start where we are. We have to understand where we are. And if we're here to develop an Eightfold Path, we have to first accept the fact that we need it. And what does that point to? It points to an awakened human being that said, this is a common human problem, a misunderstanding of who we are in relation to the world. It's a common problem. It's not something that implies that there's something wrong with each of us as individuals because we need an Eightfold Path to develop. It's simply an acknowledgement. Well, yeah, I'm a human being, and I'm stuck in the same wrong views as everyone else. That leads to development of true compassion because we understand the misunderstandings that, and wrong views that everyone's rooted in that motivate things. Some of the extreme behavior that we see today, but also the mundane behavior that is still rooted in wrong view and that we find at times unacceptable. Getting into difficulties with other people or finding things in the world that are upsetting to us, not taking things as they are. That last line too, the process of becoming and karma and rebirth. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. So what that means is what's occurring in our life right now is our karma. If you want to know what your karma is, excuse me, be mindful of what's occurring in your life. We further the momentum of karma, the present unfolding of past intentional actions as our life occurs, by either reacting to it and wanting it to be different in some way, ourselves or the situation, or accepting it because it's simply what's occurring. And this is where we get into the important but very fine definition between acceptance and approval. Because most of us have that wrapped up, that in order for me to approve of something, in order for me to accept something, I have to approve of it. And that leads to a life of mostly non-acceptance. The Buddha taught radical acceptance, meaning that we accept everything that occurs because it's what has occurred. It can't be any different. But we also have developed the wisdom to know that we don't have to approve of something and yet still accept it. So we get way past having to judge something as good, bad, skillful, unskillful, or any of that. Because you could say it doesn't really apply, does it? If we start developing the framework of the Eightfold Path and start seeing things from that perspective, then things are either in alignment with the path or they're not. And if they're not in alignment with the path and it's something that we're doing, we change that behavior. If it's what's occurring in the external world, whether it's on the other side of the globe or right in front of us in our town or with someone that we're close to, we cease reacting to it because we understand the nature of dukkha in the world and in other people. Our minds are able to remain at peace and at calm no matter what's occurring. That's a developed, awakened right view. It's what the potential in each moment is inclining us towards. Wrong view is the view that compels one to worldly attainment, acquisition, and attachment. We attach ourselves to things of the world because we have now identified with those things in the world. We've created an identity over those things. The Buddha describes that often as joining with the things of the world, but he always qualifies that as we're joining with dukkha, we're joining with suffering. When we attach ourselves to the people, events, the views, the ideals of the world, we're joining with dukkha in that way. We can remain independent of that. Initially, wrong view is simply recognized. As right view is developed, actions originating in wrong view are simply abandoned. It is wrong view that continues to develop karma and it is wrong view that, due to karma, causes rebirth. Wrong view is caused by ignorance. Right view is an expression of wisdom. The Buddha explains how right effort and right mindfulness directly contribute to developing wisdom. Those are the sixth and seventh factors of the Eightfold Path. Right effort. One tries to, the Buddha's words, one tries to abandon wrong view and to enter and to remain in right view. We simply recognize it. Very simple and direct practice, isn't it? But when, again, remember, when we're stuck in wrong view, it's very difficult to even recognize that we're in that wrong view unless we've developed the Eightfold Path to a certain extent. This is where meditation comes in initially. We need that, and this is why meditation is for deepening concentration and not for any other reason. And the reason why I'm saying it is not for exploration of the body or connecting with different things. In the meditation the Buddha taught, there's meditations that are taught for other reasons, and that's fine. It's not what the Buddha taught for a very specific reason. The Buddha taught meditation to deepen concentration for the sole reason that we have now developed a measure of concentration that is no longer distracted by dukkha. And it just takes a very shallow development of concentration to start integrating the Eightfold Path and recognizing wrong views. But we need a measure of concentration to do that. Is that clear too? And that's why we meditate. Again, it's not for experience, it's for deepening concentration. The reason why I always emphasize that is because many people, when they start to meditate, or even as they're developing their meditation practice, and I've heard this from people that have been meditating for 30 years, they're still looking for an experience during meditation, a mystical experience or a blissful experience, or even a deep and profound level of calm, even though that usually develops. Every meditation practice, if it's used appropriately, is used for deepening concentration. So no matter what the experience is, if you're using the method, you're deepening your concentration. Now, what normally follows is a deepening calm that's recognizable, and it feels good, and that's okay to acknowledge it. The only thing that I'm cautioning against is using meditation to have experiences that we want to chase after. Right? Because that takes away from concentration. I talked a little bit about this on retreat too, that using the breath as a focus is skillfully done by just using the breath as the breath is presented in the body. Meaning the breath, there's some practices where we're told to breathe through our body and breathe to the pain and breathe to this and breathe to that. Those are great practices. It's not what the Buddha taught. And if you want to use those practices, use it outside of what the Buddha taught. The breath, the Buddha taught to be mindful of the breath in the body. The breath comes into the body through the nose or the mouth and goes to the lungs, and it goes no further. It's a distraction to start directing the breath someplace where it can't go, meaning throughout the body or to my foot or something like that. Do you understand what I'm saying? So again, if you want to use some other practice, that's great. It's not what the Buddha taught. I got this question through an online student, and he said, well, the body breathes. We take oxygen into our skin, don't we? That's true. But that's assimilation. It's not respiration. And medical studies show that the oxygen that passes through the skin only goes through the first few levels of the skin anyway, which is really irrelevant. It's not respiration. The reason why I'm saying that is, if I'm sitting here trying to use the assimilation of oxygen through my skin, there's no concentration that's going to develop from that, is there? It's just foolish. Being mindful of the breath in the body is the point of focus during meditation. And that points to the eighth factor of right meditation. I'll talk more about that in 2 weeks. Right view supports and informs all of the components of the Eightfold Path. Having engaged with the Four Noble Truths, right view brings wisdom to a mind previously stuck in ignorance and confusion. The consequences of wrong views, this is the Buddha's words. In a person of wrong view, wrong resolve or wrong intention comes into being. And that wrong intention can be expressed in an infinite number of wholesome and seemingly altruistic practices that are just more distraction. And again, this isn't to put down anything else. It's to recognize the importance of developing the Eightfold Path if you want to awaken as the Buddha awakened. It's a very refined practice with very refined practices. And now, again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in other things, other wholesome activities. Just remember that Dhamma practice is Dhamma practice. The Eightfold Path is something separate. And when we start adding to it or adapting it to accommodate other things, we're losing the entire practice. I've never seen a practice that was using some of the components of the Eightfold Path. Let's say being very compassionate, which is the virtuous factors, and just meditating without recognizing that initially views are rooted in wrong views. If you're not starting from that standpoint, you'll never address it. And you will likely use these other wholesome practices to continue to ignore that ignorance. And I've seen that. I engaged with that in my first 15 years of so-called Buddhist practice. And I've seen it with so many students. I used to see it more often here. In the beginning, there was a lot of desire to do other things rather than just practice what the Buddha taught. It's just different. And again, in a person of wrong view, wrong resolve comes into being. In a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech, I won't get into too much specifics about this because, well, I just won't. But there was recently such a strong example of wrong speech by a Buddhist teacher, a modern Buddhist teacher, who manipulated other people to the point where they were so frustrated that they reacted. And it was at that point of reaction that this Buddhist teacher says, oh, you're engaged in wrong speech. The wrong speech was the initial motivation, wasn't it? But then using just the phrase of wrong speech to continue to manipulate someone else, that's something that occurs by adapting and accommodating the Buddhist teaching to fit something that it was never meant to be. In a person of wrong resolve, wrong speech. In a person of wrong speech, then wrong action follows. In a person of wrong action, wrong livelihood can often follow. In a person of wrong livelihood, wrong effort. I see that all the time, that engaged in following from that wrong speech, and now I'm talking about certain modern Buddhist practices, but really all you could say a lot of kind of New Age practices too. Following from wrong speech, wrong action follows, and then wrong livelihood. And livelihood, I mean, in any, it might be necessarily, not necessarily you're making money, but you're directing others in a certain way. And because that's rooted in wrong view, you can only continue to direct people rooted in your own ignorance. So I know this sounds like I'm judging other people or other practices harshly. I'm not. But it's important to recognize, and I see it more and more often. I had a lunch with Matt today, and we were talking about a very famous modern Buddhist teacher who mentioned something to Matt's brother, and Matt's brother called Matt and said, so-and-so said this, isn't this wonderful? And it almost brought Matt to tears and me to tears because of how far it took this person away from the Dhamma. And that really is, to me, that's the essence of wrong speech, to present something as Buddhist teachings and twist it around so much that it can only, Matt's response to his brother is, if you do this, you're going to hurt yourself, and it's true. But this is something that was, this was a famous quote by this teacher. You actually can hurt yourself by doing these things because you're continuing your own delusion. So again, the Buddha taught a very specific practice to recognize and abandon wrong views. In a person of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness will follow. In a person of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration, meaning we'll develop all kinds of different concentration practice. In a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge, and a person of wrong knowledge, wrong release, meaning there's no release from craving and clinging. This is something that the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. So it's not something that is irrelevant to our modern times, and it's not something that's only relevant. Meaning it's not something that has just developed in the last 20, 50, or 100 years, has it? The Buddha was speaking to this common human problem 2,600 years ago. And remember, that common human problem is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And the quality of a mind rooted in ignorance is to develop very often meaningful and reasonable strategies accepted by many that will continue to ignore its own ignorance. That's the real subtle problem of wrong views. It's the real subtle problem that the Buddha recognized upon his awakening. Upon the Buddha's awakening, he didn't immediately jump off and start screaming the good news. He sat and seriously considered for 2 more weeks at least if he could teach what he now understood in a way that would pierce the common human problem of ignorance, pierce that veil of ignorance. How could he do it? Because he understood that intense desire for a mind rooted in ignorance to ignore anything that would challenge that ignorance. How do I get around that deluded mind? An Eightfold Path. It's still surprising to me. Maybe surprising now is too strong of a word, but for the first 15 years or so that I was engaged in Buddhist practice, now I had gotten to the point where I took vows in a certain Tibetan school. It was that important to me, and I studied long and hard, went on many, many different retreats and empowerments and all these things. During that time, no one ever mentioned the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. And if they did, they did it in such a... Now, I'm qualifying that statement because maybe they didn't. It didn't impress me. It was mentioned in such a way that it was unimportant. And then I went into another Mahayana school, the Zen schools. And again, if the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path was mentioned, it was mentioned as an anachronism. It wasn't important. And nobody... In all that time, and now I studied with some of the most well-known Buddhist teachers. Nobody ever taught that the Buddhist path to awakening is an Eightfold Path, and this is how you integrate it, and this is why you integrate it. Nobody ever mentioned dependent origination in the way the Buddha taught it. And I'm only saying all that because now these intricate strategies that the Buddha described 2,600 years ago have developed in a remarkable way of how prevalent they are, more so than even the Buddha's time. And again, the only reason I'm saying that is the more that I'm sitting in this seat, the more I'm doing what I'm doing, it's remarkable how strong the strategies we create to continue to ignore our own ignorance. It really is remarkable. And that's the first thing that the Buddha awakened to. And he taught a way to recognize that. But as soon as we dismiss or diminish the Eightfold Path, we're dismissing or diminishing the importance of the path itself. Does anybody have a comment on that? And you can disagree with me and or say anything you want, but I really would like to hear it if you do. Lisa.
You know, it's funny, John, sitting here. Just before I came, I was working with somebody who I'm partnering with, who apparently is not in the same place of belief of you moving forward. So I didn't realize it because she doesn't express herself very well. So I'm sitting here struggling with some of that in my head and recognizing, you know, I'm like laughing. I get here, I'm like, okay, great, right view, perfect. You know, so it's accepting that what is. You know, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with that. Yeah. Gave her some of my feedback. And I'm sitting here, so I'm sitting here recognizing that there's the conflict. I see the dukkha. It's all going to change because I have no idea what the outcome's going to be. So if I'm living in this present moment, I'm here. I have to keep bringing myself back here. So I was doing that with my breath. I'm doing that even as you're speaking, changing seating so I can listen and be present. There is a question in here, or there is a statement in here of value, I think. So when I'm looking, I'm like, okay, so not wanting to fix it, like if I want to fix it or change it or make it different, then I start out with wrong view because I'm not accepting things the way they are. And I think that's where I get the little bit of the struggle is, and maybe some of the reasons why all these other practices show up is because we want to do something.
Yep.
And so I'm really truly sitting here recognizing the only thing for me to do is to sit here, to be present here, to go about my evening in my standard little eightfold path that I take, however I'm able to do it, and then get up and just do, you know, tomorrow will be tomorrow, or whatever happens in that space. So I have, what I get from it is this sense of calmness when I come right back to that space of,
yeah. Oh,
everything's just the way it is. And then nervousness comes back in, and then instead of coming to my breath right now, I'm coming to exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe I'm just thinking, like, I want to be enlightened, but the practicality of me being enlightened today is probably not likely, since I'm still trying to figure out how to get out of it. But I guess what I'm trying to wonder is, like, I guess let's ask the question is, am I in the right space? Like, am I following this path? Am I following the Dhamma, I guess is the question.
What a great, yes, and I can answer yes because you framed the question correctly in the context of the Eightfold Path. You're understanding your own process, just the fact that you're still caught up in it at times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that's irrelevant, but what's most important is the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
There's an article on the website called Mindfulness is Recognition and Renunciation, and the article is about the initial understanding of the problem and the recognition of the problem is paramount to ending the problem, and that's true about anything. If you're looking at a house that the paint's falling out and you think that splashing motor oil is going to solve the problem on the house, it's not going to work, is it? You don't understand the problem. The same is true with the Dhamma. That's why the Eightfold Path is so important. So in those moment-by-moment situations that stress is arising, as we integrate the Eightfold Path and use that as a framework for whether I'm going to engage in speech, action, or livelihood, and it's coming from the skillful side, the right side of that, we know we're good to go. And often, when we're in a situation like that, and we recognize that in this moment, in this situation, with who I'm confronted with, whether it's an individual or a group, no matter what I say, it's going to fall on deaf ears. It's not going to have any useful effect. We know at that point we keep our mouth shut. Because necessary or unnecessary speech is a factor of wrong speech. Speech that will likely fall on deaf ears is wrong speech. So right speech is often just holding your tongue. Oftentimes in the suttas, when you read the Buddha suttas, and a question will be put to the Buddha, that the question itself was rooted in ignorance and would serve no useful purpose to answer, it's described. That's the Buddha's answer. and to, in the most loving and compassionate way, to show the question itself. And sometimes when he would respond, when he knew there was a response necessary, he would say that the question itself is rooted in ignorance. I cannot answer it because of that. I had it while you were talking. I had a teacher many, many years ago. I mentioned Arnold Patton. I don't know if you remember mentioning it to him. That quote that if you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago but you believe you're in Los Angeles, you can't get there. That's one of Arnold Patton's saying. He taught something called universal principles that were in many ways similar to what the Buddha taught but in some ways quite distinct and ultimately distracting. But one of the things that he said was so useful. He says if you're sitting there and you feel this great urge to get up and do something, sit down. Stay there. Don't. And he was talking about never act in a way that is reactive, that is coming from a reactive. And that doesn't mean, you know, the question at a retreat years ago, what if you're sitting on a train track and a train is coming at you? Take two steps to the right. And, you know, we still haven't lost the ability to think critically. But in those situations where our mind is reacting in one way or another, it's always best to just relax. Do what you did. Take a breath. Practice restraint. You know, recognize that in the next moment, I'm likely to engage in eye-making, which can only further ignorance and create stress in the world. Practice restraint and just stop. Just don't do it. But understand it from the proper perspective. It's not enough to just put on the brakes in life. You have to understand why you're doing so. And that's, again, that's the framework of the Eightfold Path. It leads directly... Thank you, Lisa. That was such an important question and comment. I'm going to read the last sentence again. In a person of wrong concentration, wrong knowledge. In a person of wrong knowledge, wrong release. Meaning we're not releasing ourselves from craving and clinging to wrong views. We're simply creating a further distraction. And it feels like, it might even feel like release, but it's really escape because it's just continuing wrong views. It's escape from what's disturbing me in the moment, but because that escape is rooted in ignorance, it can only give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance, rooted in stress. The Buddha concludes that by saying, this is how from wrongness, meaning wrong views, comes failure and not success. Again, very direct teaching. Put yourself back in 2,600 years ago. It's just a direct teaching. If you want to continue to fail at understanding your own life, continue wrong views. Do nothing to change them. Or engage in strategies that will continue that. So there's a task associated, sometimes I present it this way, there's a task associated with developing each factor of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha describes that task. Be mindful of wrong view and enter and remain in right view. That's the task associated with right view. So it simply means what Lisa really described beautifully. To recognize when you're in wrong view and acting that way, thinking from that point of view, recognize it and simply abandon it. In the Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning each moment we can think a skillful, appropriate thought rather than something that is rooted in ignorance and rooted from reaction. Sometimes that reaction is a feeling, like really profound what you said, Lisa, the feeling that, well, I got to do something here. Again, Arnold Patton and the Buddha would say, when you feel like that, stop. Relax. Gain control of your mind. Think what's appropriate in this moment. Stop reacting.
Come to meditation.
Yeah, and in every situation, when we're able to do that, and again, this is an entirely practical situation. In every situation, if our minds are well framed that way, the response will be appropriate and it will likely be helpful towards ourselves and everyone around us. It will no longer contribute to the stress and suffering of the world. Sometimes it may seem like that, meaning that a right action in the present moment might not be what the people in front of us want us to be doing, right? But it's appropriate, and we understand it because we are living our lives framed by the Eightfold Path. Let me get into right intention. Right intention is having the intention to abandon all deluded views and abandon all that would continue ignorance and stress. So you can see how right intention follows at least the beginning of right view. We have to know what we're dealing with to understand what is my intention in this moment. The second noble truth is that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So right intention relates directly to that. The intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging as it occurs in our lives. And how do we do that initially? We have to have a meditation practice that starts deepening our concentration. But it starts working within those factors as soon as we start the practice. Olivia, you're relatively new to this. Do you see how that's working, how your deepening concentration is allowing you to recognize wrong views when they're occurring? And I don't mean to put you on the spot. And I will say, please don't feel like you have to answer if you don't like to, but I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I do feel like my concentration is getting better.
And are you able to pick up stresses arising as something that you're contributing to? Not, I mean, all the time, constantly, but I mean, that is, again, that's kind of what Lisa was describing. That is a profound understanding. I'm not going to say already, but that's exactly how this should develop. You start, you develop the concentration to recognize your own contributions to stress.
Yeah.
So, good for you.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that.
Excuse me for putting you on the spot.
Of things that, you know, I was creating my own stress by thinking. Which is hard, it's definitely hard to change the way you think and the way you thought forever. So it's something that I just keep practicing.
Yep.
And I'm going to continue to.
Yeah, it is. It's initially hard.
Some things might be easy.
Yep.
There's other things that
And that's the nature of conditioned mind. Another description for a mind rooted in ignorance is a mind that's conditioned to ignore its own ignorance. And that's really where the difficulty arises, because the things that we've created identities over, the things that we really associate ourselves with to the world, are the things that are hardest to let go of, because it feels like annihilation. Again, what Lisa was describing, sometimes holding your tongue feels like you're going to die. I need to say. Step back and recognize it. It's just eye making there. So thank you for sharing that with us. Right intention is also included as the second factor of the Eightfold Path, as it leads directly to the development of the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So holding in mind the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging then supports the mindfulness of right speech, action, and livelihood in seeing the wrong views that are developing or arising from wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. Just holding in mind that intention to see it. Is that clear how that leads directly to that mindfulness?
Well, when you say wrong views, like wrong speech is leading to wrong views, can you explain that a little bit more?
Thank you. It's a great question. Wrong views would support right speech and right act, or wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. In other words, we first have to have a view of the world that is wrong in the sense that it's just not seeing things clearly.
And then we do the wrong speech.
Yep. So the implication then is if you develop right view, you'll no longer be engaged in wrong speech. An awakened human being, this is the framework of the Eightfold Path. An awakened human being has integrated the Eightfold Path into their life so that there's nothing in their life that is contrary to that framework. And at first, that might seem like impossible to achieve, but it's not. It's a way of living in the world, in which we're free of confrontation within ourselves and within the world. We're simply at peace. And the example of that is the Buddha, but many other human beings that have done the same. The suttas are full of people that develop that type of awakening. It's not something that's unattainable. But it isn't attainable at all if we hold on to even a shred of wrong view, because there'll always be an aspect of defending that. But it's such an important question. And again, your question tells me that you're developing the right framework of the Eightfold Path. It takes right view to eliminate all the other factors of that. Right view initially brings a recognition of wrong views. Due to strong mental fabrications or conditioned thinking that have developed from wrong view, recognition alone is not enough to gain liberation and freedom from stress. That's another common problem. That all we really have to do is be compassionate and loving people all the time. And this is really what the Bodhisattva vow means. And we're good to go. And that ignores the problem of wrong view. If we could act in a peaceful, loving, and compassionate way all the time, we would. Because human beings are naturally loving and compassionate. I qualify that. There's people that have levels of psychopathy that really don't see that. That's something else. The great majority of human beings strive to be loving and compassionate all the time. In other words, when they do something that is hurtful towards others, we feel it, don't we? We feel regret. We feel shame. The problem is we don't understand how to act that way all the time, because we don't understand how to think that way all the time. Again, this is what the Buddha recognized. Another way of describing we don't know how to think that way all the time is that we're ignorant of thinking that way all the time. We're ignorant of Four Noble Truths. When we develop an understanding of Four Noble Truths through the Eightfold Path, we're no longer ignorant of that way of living, the way that we all strive to be, and we do it as a natural expression of who we are. That's an awakened human being. Okay, I want to get into a little bit more of right intention before we close. I'm skipping ahead a little bit to get to a certain point. Right intention is the intention to abandon all views of an impermanent self so that right view may be developed completely. I'll explain that in a second. Impermanence describes the environment in which ignorance and stress arises. Impermanence also describes the environment that a self develops ignorance, resulting in the distraction of stress. A wrong view of self develops behavior that manifests in non-virtuous ways. If it were not for a confused mind subject to stress and strongly committed to maintain its existence, there would be no need for a path of liberation. In other words, we would simply recognize that this behavior is hurtful to myself and others, and I'm going to stop it. We've been trying to do that since the beginning of historical mankind, haven't we? That's the stories in the Bible. It's the stories in most of the spiritual doctrines. The problem of hurtful behavior and why we continue to engage in it. It's not enough to say, don't act like that or you're going to be punished in some way either, is it? The Ten Commandments, even they may be divinely inspired, hasn't done much for the violence in the world, has it? Just insisting that we need to be nice people doesn't work. Why? Because of deluded thinking. This is the same thing that the Buddha sought understanding of. When he left the palace grounds for the first time, he saw the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of the people around him, and he couldn't understand it. Where does it come from? And ultimately, after 6 years of arduous practice and study and seeking, he realized it all comes from ignorance. And the problem that follows from ignorance, the need to ignore anything that would continue that ignorance, anything that would challenge that ignorance. And so that leads directly to right intention. The intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. The intention to recognize and abandon any strategies that we've created to continue to ignore our own ignorance. So that's the talk for today. We'll continue with the virtuous factors next week. And you'll see how that the virtuous factors are so important in integrating in our lives because they help us to see where we're stuck in ignorance directly. So thank you. Any questions about the talk directly? We'll go around the room. Okay. Tim, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to see everybody. I have a ton of questions, but I'm gonna think about them.
Okay.
For a while before I really respond to them to you directly and to the Sangha. This is a nice. You've talked about the Eightfold Path before, and when I first started coming here is when, for the first time, was one of these suttas, and it means so much more now. It means a lot more.
As you've learned more about it.
Right, and with my meditation practice, my concentration levels is good. But what you said is perfect, because that's exactly what I was, specifically today, because it's been very hectic for me, I was catching myself before reacting. And I noticed my ego trying desperately to tell me to ignore that and react. And it got me a little shaken a little bit sometimes. And I basically would just, after... I didn't do anything to react, so that was good. But, it bothered me afterwards because it was almost like my ego was like, well, now you're going to feel guilty about that. You're going to feel a little guilty about the fact that you wanted to react. Okay, we're not going to let you off the hook. And then I was thinking about the Eightfold Path, and I'm like, well, this is what the meditation's doing. The meditation and understanding some of the tenets of the Eightfold Path is allowing me, as a rookie, to see these things as they're approaching. It does create a lot of questions because naturally, although they may seem simple, they're hard to grasp within our human life, within the way we go around things. I mean, when you talk about intentions and right view, I mean, there's context. Yeah. In any situation, any intention could be... one step to the left or right of an intention can make it a bad intention, even though you're trying to do good. And so, not fully understanding those things. So I'm going to keep reading and keep meditating and see if those things come up. But I appreciate the Sangha talking about this and everybody's giving their opinions and thoughts and experiences with it. And I truly appreciate this sutta as well, because it helped me out a lot today. So.
Welcome. Thank you, Tim. So again, you're describing seeing things from a different perspective than you would have 3 months ago. Another word for perspective is view. You're developing right view, and that you're describing how to develop it perfectly. It's experiential. It's you first learn from a teacher or from a book what the Buddha's practice is about, but it doesn't take on any meaningful purpose until you actually have the experience. It's not anything that can be used conceptually. You have to apply it in those practical ways. And then you start getting an understanding of how it really works. It takes a bit of time.
I'm in no rush.
But that's the point. That's the usefulness of time. I don't agree with a lot of what the Dalai Lama says. Excuse me for saying that. I do agree with some of it. One of the things that he said is that the purpose of time is to awaken. It is, isn't it? What's the most important thing? And most of us, unless we're Bahia, you heard me tell that story, I won't right now. We have the time, but we don't know how much time. But we have the time. So the most important thing is to engage in right effort. We'll talk about that in 2 weeks. But aren't we fortunate that we have these teachings? They're still available. And that we have minds that can understand these teachings. You know, I don't mean that we need an extraordinary mind, but we have, there's a way that human beings think, basically, that can understand this. Isn't that remarkable? To me, it's the most remarkable thing of my lifetime that I've come across. So, thank you. Mike, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. Always great to be here. So I'm trying to wrap my brain around something which, right from the air, is a challenge. About right speech, and if you're saying something that's falling on deaf ears, that it's wrong speech. In my younger days, I was very closed-minded about a lot of things, and what opened my mind was people, friends, family, having the belief in me that I was open to change, even though I was stubborn about it, and banging on the door and getting me to say, oh, wow, that's right, and what I've been thinking is wrong. So I'm thinking, if they, and I'm not trying to take this too literally, but if they practice right speech, they might have said, he's a lunkhead, he's not going to get it, so why bother? But if they hadn't done that, I would not be here today. I would not have been open to coming to this class from the beginning. So I'm trying to kind of put some parameters around that, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. You're not taking it too literally, but you are taking it slightly out of context.
Okay.
My parents told me, as long as I can remember, don't smoke, don't drink, don't do this, don't do that. I did it anyway. It doesn't mean that they were engaged in wrong speech. They were simply being responsible parents.
Mm-hmm.
So just to make the point, so to take that to an extreme view would be, well, they should have told you to smoke and drink, and right?
Sure.
Because then I would have acted on it. So that means that it's right speech. Everything is in context. So when we're trying to support other people and we're guiding them in a certain way that we know is wholesome, so I'm kind of guessing that what was being told to you was wholesome things. Even though you didn't immediately take to it, doesn't mean that it was wrong speech. What we're talking about is in the moment, as we as individuals, not what's going on in the other world. So we could, right now I could give you a long list of people that are constantly engaged in wrong speech, right? What good is it? Now that's just more distraction. And it's actually gossip. This guy said this, and this guy tweeted that, and they said this. And giving an example of wrong speech is not necessarily right speech either, is what I'm saying. What we're saying, what's coming out of our mouth in the situation that we're involved in, is where we apply these factors, including right speech. So in the moment, when you're dealing with someone, and you know that whatever you have to say is not likely to be taken well or even taken at all, it's just a waste of time. It's wrong speech. It's idle. Another word for that is idle chatter. So engage in just constant conversation for the conversation's sake is really wrong speech. And we do that all the time. Now, again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have conversations about the weather or, you know, sports or anything, or politics. But also we can practice restraint at that level too. We don't have to always be engaged in constant chatter with people. That is basically meaningless, do we? Why? Because it's a distraction to ourselves and it's a distraction for other people. It's another aspect of wrong speech. Speech that is necessary is an aspect of right speech. Is it really necessary that I be saying what I'm saying right now? Some people would say no. He's not saying anything that's useful. Is it really useful what I'm engaging in? If not, keep your mouth shut. It's okay to be quiet. You know, well, I don't want to get into that right now. I could go on too far. Am I making myself clear?
No, you are. And this probably applies because I've got a family gathering coming up in a few weeks. And some family who I get along with very well and like. And I know the course of, you know, hanging out and eating, whatever, discussions are going to come up in topics. And, you know, so I know some people who are really good people, you know, good spouses, good parents, good providers, all these other things, who just have some very, very wrong-headed views. And I'm confident enough in saying that I'm so convinced that my view is right on this that it's not even kind of debatable. I mean, this is, and I'm not saying that out of ego. This is just like, you know, this is basically the way you treat people.
Yeah.
Okay, and they don't believe in that for whatever, without getting too deep. But, and so I want to keep trying to get through. And I'm hoping that something I say at some point will click. Only because of my own experience in which I was so resistant to things before. And then somebody said something that finally clicked. And it was literally like, poof, the lights went on. And I'm like, wow, I never realized that before. So yeah. I'm trying to kind of pass that over or down or whatever on to somebody else.
Yep.
So
it's a great opportunity to practice right speech. Just because what you're saying is contrary to other people's beliefs, even though you know that it's contrary, doesn't mean that it's wrong speech if you say something. Again, using the framework of the Eightfold Path, you're trying to be helpful. If your intention in saying something is to insist that people listen to it and change, then it's wrong speech. But if it's simply a loving expression of who you are and your understanding in the world,
right.
You're good to go.
It's not like I want to win debate points and say, you know, I came out smarter than you. It's just trying to kind of get through on things.
What's your intention is really what guides that.
Okay.
And if your intention is guided by recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging, and it's free of that, and your words, your actions, your deeds are loving and compassionate, honest, all those things, you're fine. Use the framework of the Eightfold Path to guide whatever. We can get, again, take it to extreme and say, well, I just can't have any conversations with people. And I've had people say that.
A lot of people say
I mean, the implication is that if you're going to engage in right speech, you're not going to be talking a lot. But that's okay. You know, we don't have to. But we also have to live in the world. It doesn't do us any good to alienate ourselves from our family and friends simply because we feel we can't say anything. But keep your thoughts and the resulting words, keep them framed by the Eightfold Path. If you find yourself in a situation, it might even be a family situation, that you're just engaged in hurtful speech, talking, you know, gossiping about people, or maybe even talking about politics in a way that is hurtful towards individuals, it's time to move away from that, just because it's hurtful. And it's never good to support that in any way. You know, but that's, we're also living in a rather divisive world, aren't we? That's nothing new. This was common in the Buddhist time. There were always little kingdoms that were, you know, we're the best, take my side, you know, and talk about the others that way. The sutta the other night was about that, you know, the Sundari Sutta, about opposing views and how to deal with that. So it's an important question. Always use the framework of the Eightfold Path as best you can to guide you in those situations, and you'll continue to develop the path. So, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Olivia, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Nice to see everyone. The sutta, that's what they call it, like what you were teaching us?
Yep.
Was awesome. And I've been trying to practice the right speech.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely been acknowledging when something is wrong speech, but I still struggle with actually not saying it. And I think, you know, what is my intentions? Like, why do I say certain things? And I realize I think it's just to entertain myself, to just kind of amuse myself, I think. So that I acknowledge, and having a little bit of a hard time to actually not say something when I want to say it. But I have turned off, I used to watch a lot of like IDTV and stuff that, you know, I realized was not really filling myself with positivity. I don't know if that sort of I remember you'd mentioned something about what we engage in.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Even though this might not necessarily go along with this completely.
It does.
But I actually twice I turned off IDTV on Netflix because it was just like a family that got slaughtered, and I realized like I've seen enough of these things. And I put on, you know, a documentary about like China, and I realized like I actually felt better about myself. Like the benefit of that is that like I wasn't watching negative stuff, and then I actually was watching something that was like sort of like educational and interesting, so I felt like I had benefited from it.
Yeah.
And then I also was able to say, you know, like, oh, I had a little bit of self-control, you know, and found myself enjoying doing what I would consider to be like more positive.
Yeah.
You know, engaging in more positive stuff. So I guess I did that. Yeah, I guess what you were saying about the wrong speech, right speech, and your family, and trying to like, I guess like enlighten them on like, you know, what you've learned and stuff like that. I think that's really great. And then I guess if they have something negative to say to you, then you also get to practice the right speech because you don't have to go back and, you know, like engage in whatever they're saying, right?
Yeah.
That makes sense. Like, I don't know.
that's outstanding, Olivia. You're really gaining a great understanding. And the just making more wholesome choices for your life is the beginning. Going from a violent show to something that's educational is a wholesome choice. You're developing a more mindful way of living in the world, and this is just how it works. Your thinking is changing, your view is changing, and you're recognizing the hurtfulness of certain behaviors. You know, so again, that's all rooted in the Eightfold Path. So good for you. Thank you for sharing it.
So I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Can I just interject on one thing? Just from what Mike said and Olivia was talking about, and from what I was talking about, one thing I'm noticing here is intention. So with response to right speech, intention comes first, yes, because if your intention, or if one's intention is to make peace with somebody, you ask yourself and oneself, if I'm going to have this speech, is this speech going to accomplish that? And if it doesn't, if it's going to cause somebody getting upset or hurt or offended, then perhaps that speech isn't going to do the intended purpose. Do you see what I'm saying?
Even if the speech itself is loving, if that's the...
talked about that show. If her intention was to turn on TV and be entertained and maybe learn something, and she saw a show that was just making her feel horrible, then the intended purpose of watching a show is not, that's not the right thing. So, naturally, you turned it off, which was perfect, right? Because it's just going to cause suffering and dukkha in your life. Am I getting that from what they're saying, what Mike said and Olivia said? Is that?
Yeah. It's ultimately the choice we have in each moment, meaning that moment that Olivia was describing, while it didn't lead immediately to a fully awakened human being, is moving towards that. That moment held the potential for Olivia, excuse me for using you as an example, to continue behavior that was obviously not skillful and moving it towards more skillful behavior. And that's how it works. That's practically how it works. It's more of an example of right action. Now, again, you can take it to an extreme and use it to say, well, isn't any TV a distraction? Oh, okay. But we have to live where we are. We have to begin where we are. So again, it's an action that's rooted in wisdom. And that's exactly that's the practical way. You know, that's the again.
Thank you for letting me interrupt.
Yeah. Did that?
Yeah. Well, I was just noticing that. That's all. I was just noticing that it's a slippery slope.
It can be.
Especially when it comes to family or friends. You know, do you want to object something if you have the right intention and it comes across being then the intended speech failed.
Here's the thing that in any situation. It's good to be helpful, but we also... The Buddha didn't teach anything until he awakened. And there's a lesson there. Because he didn't understand how to interact with people in the most skillful way. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be helpful and compassionate to people. But if we're looking to really change other people, we're probably better off to wait till we're awakened to do that. I'm serious about that. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be helpful to... If we see, if we see family members that are drinking themselves to death, it's a good thing to try to do something about it with the understanding that you might not be able to. You understand that's not wrong action when you try to do that. But to have an expectation, because just because I'm saying something that person should listen to me, you're in trouble there. So again, there's been a lot of harm done in the world by people thinking that they were doing something that was good and skillful. And, you know, pick an example. Pick the Christian Crusades. Pick the modern jihadists. I use this as an example, not to get people upset, but to make the point. Adolf Hitler believed in what he was doing was good. That's how deluded he was. So we have to have a level of understanding before we're going to become engaged. There's a whole movement in Western Buddhism called Engaged Buddhism. You've got people that have no measure of awakening. They're out there going to change the world. They're creating a lot of conflict in the world from that. So I'm sorry, I'm getting into a little speech.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we need to have a perspective before we're going to try to change other people in the world.
Can I add something?
Please.
I wanted to say to you, even if you can't change some of your family members' like opinions on certain things, I think it's awesome that you can like lead an example. You know what I mean? Like, so you're still doing something by leading the example.
Yeah, I mean, that, like I said, you know, I had friends who beat my brain in, you know, not literally, obviously, but, you know, about certain things because they were like, you know, they see enough in me to know that if you push hard enough, it's going to get through. Mm-hmm. And this is not like, you know, oh, I think, you know, the upper tax rate should be 40% rather than 30 or something like that. I mean, these are really kind of, you know, basic human issues and how people interact and things like that. And I guess I'm responding to their wrong views, which I see as just totally wrong. I'm like, come on, you know better. You're a good person. You're a good parent. You have all these other things. Why don't you see this? And I feel a need to keep trying.
Well, here's the thing, though, Mike. This comes from an understanding of the nature of dukkha that is prevalent in the world. The Buddha taught that dukkha occurs. It's simply a consequence of being in the world. That applies to other people. So other people, we may think that the way to see the world is through the perspective of right view. Most people don't see that. But I don't think that they should see the way that I see things, because dukkha explains that. It's a consequence of living in the world. So there's no conflict in me that everybody doesn't believe what I believe. I really believe that if everybody would just practice the Eightfold Path, we would be living in that utopic paradise that we think we're possible. But I also, that we think is possible, I understand that it's probably not. So I don't concern myself with it. I don't go out on, and the only place that I really talk about the Buddha's teachings is right here. Even when I was teaching in other places, I don't go too far. Maybe I do, Kevin. You can tell me if I do. But I don't go as far as I do here because it's simply not appropriate. So I've known you long enough to know you have an incredibly compassionate heart. You really care about people, not just your family. You care about everyone. It's hard sometimes to not want to change the people that we're closest to, but most of the time we can't. All that we can do is be an example. So, you know, I'll use my own family I come from a long line of unsuccessful drunks. They're all over the place. I'm the only person, as far as I know, and I'm going back generations to grandfathers, I'm the only one in that whole line of unsuccessful drunks that ever stopped drinking. To this day, I'm the black sheep in the family. It's just the way it is. And the only thing that I can do is be an example to all the rest of those people in my family, because I've talked to every one of them that I thought I could be helpful to, and basically I said, not your problem. So maybe that doesn't have... It's a little bit of a tangential situation. The most important thing we can do if we're concerned about other people and the world around us is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, because that's the most effective thing we can do. And it's what the Buddha taught. The Buddha did not set out to save the world. He didn't set out to save any individual person. But when people came to him for understanding, he presented the Dhamma. And when they didn't, he didn't. So even that has an aspect of dukkha, meaning even that is an there's an unsatisfying aspect to that, isn't there? That we can't change the world. Dukkha occurs. That gives us understanding of why it's unsatisfying. Every one of us in this room wishes that just by wishing we could change the whole world, don't we? We all want peace. We all want sanity in the world. We don't want any nukes. We don't want any violence. We don't want guns. We don't want corruption. What do we have? Nukes, corruption, violence. What's the problem? Ignorance. What can I do about it? Not be any more ignorant. I can wake up. It's the only thing that I can do. The most loving thing I can do for myself and for those that I care the most about and for the entire planet is to wake up. It's the most important thing. So if I really do care about my brothers and sisters in that long line of unsuccessful drunks, what can I do about it? I can maintain my Dhamma practice, and when the opportunity is there, I can act with mindfulness and compassion. So, great discussion. I hope you don't feel like I'm picking on you or Olivia.
No, not at all.
It really comes down to that fine point. If we really care about others, take care of ourselves first by waking up. Olivia.
I heard that the mindfulness, they're doing it in some certain schools now. I don't know if that's, but like you were saying, just like practicing it ourselves and stuff like that.
Yep.
I mean, who knows? Maybe in a certain period of time, there will be, you know, even more people practicing mindfulness and it'll change a lot, you know?
I agree with that completely. mindfulness is great, and that they're teaching it in schools in a general way is wonderful, because that will open minds to the way that the Buddha taught mindfulness, which is a little bit more refined. But you're not going to teach the Four Noble Truths to 10-year-olds. You're just not going to do it. I would try.
Here's what I say. Is it better to...
Oh, yeah. Mindfulness...
But, I mean, is it better to be an adult?
No.
Because I want to do this stuff with my daughter when she gets older, you know?
How old's your daughter?
She's only 6 months.
Give it six more months, then bring her to class. I've taught kids as young as 10 to meditate and to use mindfulness in a very general way, and they just take to it greatly. You know, you don't get into a lot of the suttas. By the way, means teachings of the Buddha that came from a set of books called the Sutta Pitaka, which is part of a larger group of a book called the Pali Canon, which are the preserved teachings of the Buddha. So that's a sutta, that's all that it means, the direct teachings of the Buddha.
Okay, yeah, I'm not like, I don't know all the lingo and terms and stuff. Like.
Just ask.
I want to get your book.
Yeah, it's out there, so take it. please, just take the book and enjoy it. Get to Kevin. This is one of those times where I really feel like talking, but I don't think we want to be here till 10 o'clock. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Well, today is the anniversary of the first time I came to one of your talks.
Wow! That's great.
And it is such a different... I'm different. And well, I think I'm just more cognizant of things of the Eightfold Path and of the Dhamma.
Yeah.
When I first started, it was, you know, I had been meditating for 6 weeks, and it was really about the meditation. You know, I thought there was the magic of the meditation, and there is that peacefulness that comes out of meditation, even before you know the Dhamma. But I meditated in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, that I just came to that, and that's what I started to learn. And you could see, you know, I had enough concentration developing, I guess, to be able to, when we met you, it was like, oh my gosh, this is the same thing that I'm reading about, and this is so amazing that somebody is actually teaching this. And now I've had the benefit of a whole year of these teachings, and I thank you, and these retreats that I've gone on, and you know, I think it just, again, you know, it's the Dhamma. And it's interesting that here we are 1 year and we're starting at step one. Yeah. You know, right view. Four Noble Truths, and right view, and right intention. And it's good to start every day with that, every moment with that. So, and then you know, it fills the old, you know, right view is the Eightfold Path. Right view is the Four Noble Truths. And it's just such an amazing thing for me how it just folds on itself, or it is a wheel and it keeps turning.
Yeah.
And it's a chain and it's all connected. But I just wanted to, you know, celebrate our anniversary.
Yeah.
And then to encourage people who are new to it to continue in that path.
Happy anniversary, my friend. Thank you. It really is wonderful. Hey, Kevin donated the Buddha bus there, too. So thank you for that. It's entirely appropriate. It came from Hudson, New York, where we have our retreats just outside of Hudson. So it's entirely appropriate. The long earlobes signify the wisdom of the Buddha. So we'll all start developing that. Lisa, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Thank you, everybody, for everything you shared. And I always love this line of keeping it green.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you asked your questions, all of you, because I was sitting here thinking to myself, did I handle this properly earlier on? Because when this conflict took place, my response was, as a business owner, we need to be on the same page. That's what I said, and she kind of looked a little freaky, and I shared some wisdom with her from the standpoint of well, it's funny, I want to call it law of attraction, but it's karma. It's the same thing. It's similar thing.
Yeah.
It's karma. It's like what's going to come is what you're putting out. So if you're putting that something's not going to work, well, that's what you're going to get back. So I basically had this conversation with her, and I did it with a deep breath, and I did it with consciousness. And but then when I was listening to her, I'm like, oh, I should have kept my mouth shut. And it's funny, it's like, and then Mike, so thank you for bringing up, you know, asking your question and bringing that up, because all of a sudden I'm like, no, I did what I did. The intention was just clear. The intention was to bring us to the same place. There was no clinging, craving, or desire in that part, and that's what I think about from right intention. Is like, am I trying to do something with this? I wanted it to be a little bit different, but I realized that I'm running a business, so I still had to live in the moment. And then I let it be. And the first time, and probably the only time I will actually have a discussion with it, will be here, because I'm going to leave it.
Yeah.
But I want to appreciate the fact that I was able to do it. The timing was so perfect, and listening to right view. And honestly, I know the Eightfold Path, but I haven't heard it so clearly as I heard it tonight. So it was simple, easy, clear, bell ringing. Thank you. Just thank
you. I finally learned how to teach it. The Dhamma is just like that. You hear something 100 times, 1,000 times, and then you just hear it. And you know. A lot of the Dhamma was that way with me. When the first time I came across dependent origination, which now when I look at it is such a simple and basic teaching, it's obvious. I had no idea what it meant because I didn't have a context in what to fit it in. And that's, again, that's, you need to understand the context. So thank you for all that. Just a wonderful class. Again, the implication of your question shows me that you're all really getting it, because you're finding ways to apply it in your life, which is exactly how the Dhamma works. It's not concepts. It's all practical. And even having the basic concern is, how do I share this, or how do I be with people that I care deeply for, is a profound question when you think about that. It's a question that is the completely opposite of ignorance. You're seeking ways to be engaged meaningfully in other people's lives. And how can we best do it? We take to the Dhamma and awaken. The essence of an awakened life is a meaningful life, meaning every moment is meaningful because nothing's wasted. Every word, every action. When you read the suttas, the Buddha talked a lot. Probably not as much as I do, but he talked. Every word he ever uttered was a useful word. He never wasted any word. He never wasted any time. He never wasted anybody else's time. He always got to the point. Led a meaningful life. And we're all talking about that. Every one of you is describing developing a much more meaningful life. What more could we want? Yeah. What more could we want? Thank you. Thank you for a great class. Again, I always, any other questions before we finish with Metta? Our Dhamma dinner is November 21st, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. There's info on crossrivermeditation.com. But please come. Please bring your family. It's an open dinner. Dhamma, the Love and Oven, will make the main course. They usually make a turkey and some salads and sides and desserts. And then everybody that can brings a dish to share. And it's just a wonderful evening. So I hope you can all come. There's a donation box out there that we're collecting money to give to the staff at Love and Oven to pay for the kitchen help and the cook and all that. For years, Julie Klein, who's the owner, she never mentioned it, and for some reason I never asked, but I finally did, and I realized that she shouldn't bear that burden alone. So we're taking donations for that. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.